The court will now call Candace Jackson versus Kell Auto Sales Incorporated and Robert Harmon. May it please the court, Mr. David Rasmussen will argue for the appellant. Mr. Stephen K. Hayes will argue for the appellee.
Thank you.
May it please the court, thank you for the opportunity to argue our case before the hearing was called for. Thank you to on behalf of Mayor Weston for hosting it. I graduated from this institution, so it's nice to see something like this come back. I am David Rasmussen. I represent the appellant, Ms. Candace Jackson, who's actually here today. She's in the audience with us today. Before the court is the sole issue of whether the Texas Citizens Participation Act is the proper mechanism to dismiss the defendant's counter lawsuit against Ms. Jackson. And we believe that it is because Ms. Jackson met her burden of the first step under the analysis, the three-step analysis for the Texas Citizens Participation Act. The lower court is required, the language is mandatory, to review all the pleadings as well as any evidence or affidavit before them to determine if the Texas Citizens Participation Act applies. And we believe that it does apply. And we believe the best way to look at this is to take their counter lawsuit, outside the lawsuit, and look at what it actually is, and then how it's been used in the lawsuit. Ms. Jackson has brought a deceptive trade practices claim and a common law fraud claim against Kell Auto and Mr. Harmon for activities that occurred in the sale of the vehicle. The counter lawsuit, as taken out of the lawsuit, is set up. Their claim is that Ms. Jackson came down to Kell Auto, purchased the vehicle, she paid cash, full price, cash money, took possession of that vehicle, and then somehow was obligated to fulfill their duty to take the vehicle to get it inspected at a particular mechanic. And because she didn't do that, and including in the presenting it to a particular mechanic, he was going to fix unknown and unidentified repairs that it may have been on his hand.
Councilman, may you?
Yes.
Based upon my review, this is a dispute between two parties about a personal transaction between them, correct?
That is correct.
All right. So we go back to the first question, which is, does the Texas Citizens Participation Act even apply in this case? Now, bear with me, I'm going to run down a rabbit trail for, based upon what the briefing is that I've seen. And that is that what you're saying is that your client has exercised her right to petition by filing a lawsuit.
That is correct.
And so that's what you're anchoring in the TCPA, right?
I'm anchoring that as well as the other activity that occurred in the case.
Okay, but there's no free speech issue, right?
That is correct.
And there's no right association issue.
That is correct.
So the anchor issue of the TCPA is the right to petition.
That is correct.
All right. If you accept your premise here, which is that filing a lawsuit, which is your right to petition, anchors you into the TCPA, then any text which has a counterclaim that's filed after an original claim is going to be subject to, well, the counterclaim was filed in response to the exercise of the right to petition, right?
I can't speak for all scenarios, but in this particular one, that is
the case. I understand. I'm looking at it from the 30,000 foot level.
Sure.
Right? Which is that, are we going to be creating precedent that whenever a case is filed, that is a right, an exercise of the right to petition, and that anything which is filed after that is subject to being argued as being in response to that, aren't we going to be vastly broadening the scope or the applicability of the TCPA?
Possibly.
Okay, so when the legislature passed the amendments in 2019, can you agree that what they were trying to do was to restrict the scope of the TCPA, not broaden?
I would agree that that is partially true. I think they're trying to get a handle on how it was
look back to two cases in particular, one from this court, which was the COCAT versus Antero Resources case, and the Houston court deals with Gascan versus WSP USA. In dicta, in both of those cases, the courts stated that one of the aspects of the TCPA is that there needs to be a public or common interest as opposed to any lawsuit, right?
What you said is correct. However, with the right to petition, it took out the matters of public concern in the statute itself, and that's not a required element. In our particular case, the countersuit is being used as a weapon.
So you're saying that there was actually language that was actually removed from the pre-2019 version about public interest or common?
If I said that as well, I'm saying that the way the statute's written now since the inception of this case, that requirement is not in that statute. It may have been there, but I don't know that.
I don't recall it being there before, and so that was basically the courts trying to make sense out of the TCPA so that we're not talking about every case we said the TCPA, because when it got started, it was applied very broadly. Right?
It was, and it's still supposed to, there's still supposed to be a broad net cast upon it. And the way that we're using it here, I believe, specifically addresses the purpose the legislature had, which is it's being used here as a weapon to intimidate our client. And if you look at what they're actually claiming in the lawsuit, I think it's fairly evident. And then if you add that with the pleadings, which the court is required to look at along the way, that we've met our burden. And I would argue to you that in their countersuit, they don't even identify any affirmative relief other than attorney fees. That's the weapon being used. It's not a meritorious, it has no merit. It's a meritless cause of action. Their cause of action, or countersuit, is a breach of contract that she paid cash for the vehicle, took the vehicle home, and then didn't present it to a mechanic the next day. They violated the law. They're required by law under the Texas Transportation Code to have that vehicle inspected within 180 days prior to the day of sale. Not the day of sale, prior to the day of sale. And they didn't do that, and somehow they're claiming that there's a contract to pass that duty onto our client.
But hasn't the legislature created a separate statute in the Civil Rights and Remedies Code dealing with the merits claim? Chapter 9.
Yes, okay, yes. Yes, that does exist.
Okay, so is the purpose of the Civil Rights and Remedies Code, Chapter 27, to deal with meritless claims, or is it to deal with claims that fall under the civil practice, the Texas civil practice, and TCPA, Citizens Participation Act?
I believe we actually pled both those.
But what was the motion that was set? TCPA, right?
We did. There was two counterclaims that filed against her, and we joined them together. We did a 91A, which I believe is another mechanism to bring forward.
91A
is a frivolous lawsuit, and then we also went for sanctions under the Civil Practice Remedy Code for the frivolous pleading, as well as a dismissal of the claim itself under the Citizens Participation Act, because any suit that appears to stifle a person's constitutional right is subject to the Citizens Participation Act. So we use that mechanism to try to get this case dismissed. We believe we met our burden, not only through what I just described in the counterclaim, which is there's no relief whatsoever, but also through the procedural history. If I could run you through the procedural history real quick, I think that it would show itself. So we filed a lawsuit, and they filed an answer, obviously. We pled it as a level 1 case. Discovery begins. During discovery, they again amend their answer and add an assortment of affirmative defenses. They also file a motion to compel mediation. Discovery proceeds and expires December of 20. And we go to mediation. Mediation fails. We then file the no evidence summary judgment to attack the affirmative defenses. And in response to that, they take two of the affirmative defenses and turn them into two counter lawsuits.
But the court denied motion for summary judgment.
The answer to both of those are yes. The no evidence summary judgment, which has a different standard than the Citizens Participation Act, was denied. The 91A also was denied and hasn't been addressed yet in terms of an appeal, which we're entitled to do. But both those were dismissed. But this court reviews under de novo, so those don't have any bearing on your decision today in regards to the law. And so once we attacked their affirmative defenses, they took two of them and turned them into a counter lawsuit. And the major difference between an affirmative defense and a counter lawsuit is the relief sought, affirmative relief. They pled no affirmative relief. They merely said that what their relief is attorney fees, which to and how we take that is that's a lawsuit to intimidate our client, to threaten her with having to pay their attorney fees if she doesn't win a lawsuit. So
could be in our complaint.
I'm sorry.
It could be in our complaint, couldn't it?
I would agree that's possible, but he didn't amend it even after we filed. No amendment to their answer and counterclaim. We did not. We went the Citizens Participation Act, one because of the time restraint, and also because we felt that was a proper mechanism. Because it is a lawsuit that is, it's a retaliatory lawsuit.
Well, so that's your conclusion, right?
That is our conclusion, yes.
See, this gets into a potential concern here is that if a counterclaim is alleged to be a basis for a retaliatory action for the right of petition, then that puts the trial judge and ultimately us eventually to having to pull out the binding rod and say, okay, well, based upon the course of events which occurred, we're supposed to infer the motive for why they did this, correct?
I disagree with that slightly. And the reason I disagree with that is because the code outlines the mechanism to clear that up. So once we've met our burden, they then have to produce clear, specific evidence for each element of the cause of action to create a prima facie case.
But then the first step to your burden is establishing that their allegations fall under the TCPA.
Correct.
And so that's what we have to figure out is whether or not, in all cases, not just cases with a common interest or a public interest, but in all cases, including private cases like this, that we're going to be called upon on innumerable cases to have to divine somebody's intentions based upon the order of the pleadings that they did, right?
As well as how they're using it. In this particular case, their cause of action isn't even a cause of action. And the purpose of the Citizens Participation Act is to protect meritorious lawsuits and get rid of meritless lawsuits. So just the filing of a counterclaim, I don't believe would bring it under the Citizens Participation Act. Like, I believe that's what you're saying. There's got to be more than that. And in this particular case, we have more than that.
And that's what I want to know about. So other than the fact that there's not necessarily a particular belief sought, as you mentioned, and timing, the fact that it was quickly filed after discovery ended, what else do we have to make us believe that this counterclaim is a weapon, as you characterize it?
Well, I believe those two are accurate. I believe if you also look at what they're claiming to be a cause of action, that also identifies it, which they're not really, it's not a cause of action. To be frank, it's a frivolous lawsuit that's being used in this lawsuit as a way to intimidate our client.
But you have remedies available beyond the TCPA for dealing with frivolous claims, right?
Yes, I believe the frivolous claim can be addressed for a 91A, and then I also think the Citizens Participation Act is appropriate for that, considering the way they're using it, which is to intimidate our client, because they're just wielding this threat of attorney fees against her, and no other relief is sought.
So y'all went to mediation, obviously it didn't work out.
Believe it or not, it's 20 minutes.
All right, so do you think that their motivation is to get Ms. Jackson to just dismiss her lawsuit?
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it for her to give up and not continue to pursue. I also think there's an element to deter future litigation from people that may purchase cars and identify that they don't address, they don't comply with the law as they're supposed to.
You're talking about the transportation code?
Yes.
As far as the procedural posture you were alluding to, we're up here on this interlocutory appeal just on the TCPA. The 91A was dismissed. Are there other issues still pending?
Yes, Your Honor. The 91A moved to be addressed for the revenue names to the same court. And also, you know, we were scheduled, the trial should under the level 1 and 169 expedite action. The trial should have occurred in January, but obviously they pushed back to COVID.
Yeah, and in theory, whether we remand or affirm, this case, there's still going to be issues that have to be dealt with at the trial.
There are still trial issues, but they would just be Ms. Jackson's cause of action at that point. So we are asking you to send the case back for the directive to dismiss the county lawsuit for breach of contract against Ms. Jackson. So I see that I'm out of time. Is there any other question? Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel for having me.
I believe that the first of all, may I please report, Mr. Rasmussen. I believe the quickest way, most efficient way for this court to address and resolve this case and affirm the trial court's order is to deal with the issue, this issue, that Ms. Jackson failed to demonstrate that Kellogg's counterclaim was predicated on a communication by her in a judicial proceeding or a communication by Ms. Jackson pertaining to a judicial proceeding. I'd like to start out, and if you have the handout that I brought with me and want to follow along, I'm behind tab 3 right now. It bears, I think, some importance to look at the statutory language. The first thing I'd like to look at, which is I put behind tab 4, but I don't think there's any disagreement on this. In Ms. Jackson's brief, she conceded that the phrase in the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which says that a legal action must be based on or in response to the exercise of the right, that phrase based on or in response to means that the counterclaim here has to be predicated on the exercise of the right. She conceded that in her brief. She did not address this court's two decisions, one in Garrison and the other in Bedford versus Fields, where this court accepted and applied that predicated on a test. With that in mind, and turning back to tab 3, 27.05 of the TCPA says when a court shall dismiss a counterclaim such as Kellogg's, it can dismiss such a counterclaim here if Jackson demonstrates that the legal action is based on or in response to, that is predicated on, Jackson's exercise of the right to petition. The right to petition is defined in 27.01 as meaning a communication in a judicial proceeding or pertaining to a judicial proceeding. Pertaining to, if you look up in Merriam-Webster's dictionary, that means having as its subject matter. So in other words, what she had to demonstrate to show clearly, unmistakably, clearly, is that Cal Baldwin's counterclaim was predicated on a communication by her in a judicial proceeding or pertaining to, that is, having as its subject matter, a judicial proceeding. If you look behind tab 5, I've put Kellogg's counterclaim there in its entirety. We notice two things. Talks about Ms. Jackson buying a vehicle that Kellogg on the day of sale, and this is what's pointed out in the record, is that it takes vehicles on the day of sale to have them inspected and text on the fleet at its own expense. If that inspection reveals any repairs that are necessary to pass inspection, Kellogg pays for those repairs. That's what it normally does, but in this instance, Ms. Jackson didn't want to wait to take possession of the vehicle. This is what's played. She took possession of the vehicle on that day. She agreed to take the vehicle instead of letting Cal Auto do it. She agreed to take the vehicle to Texoma Fleet for inspection and repairs, and she never did so. And that was a breach of contract. Furthermore, there seems to be some misunderstanding that I will clarify now. In the counterclaim, we specifically plead in the next Cal Auto pleads in the next paragraph that her breach of contract has caused damages to Cal Auto in excess of minimum jurisdiction amounts in this court.
So I think there were no special exceptions filed.
There's not none of them, Your Honor. There's none in the appellate record, and I don't know anything about those ones. Two things about this. Number one, when you look at these allegations, they are not predicated on a communication in or pertaining to, excuse me, a judicial proceeding. They are predicated on her promise to take the vehicle, to have it inspected, have it repairs made, at Cal Auto's expense, and her failure and refusal to do that, the damages that Cal Auto sustained.
So would Cal Auto have sued her in an original petition? Had she not sued first?
Brings me to my second point. If you look at the counterclaim, this counterclaim could have been filed verbatim as a standalone lawsuit within a week of when she bought the vehicle.
Let me take you back in the record.
Yes, sir.
This is a private action. Both sides agree on that right now, right?
Yes, I believe so.
And if you look back to the pre-2019 version of the statute, we at least have two cases that in dicta say that you need to have either a public interest or a common interest, as opposed to a purely private interest to come under the TCPA, right?
Yes, I believe that's right.
Were there changes that you're aware of made in the 2019 amendments to the TCPA, which would indicate that the legislature intended to broaden the application of the statute to include all cases where you have petition and then a counterclaim, which appears to be in response to a party's exercise of the right of petition?
Judge Walling, I'd have to go back and look, and I didn't study that question. I do believe that public concern used to be pre-2019 was a statutory element condition, whatever you call it, of the right to petition, I think. I'm not sure. I didn't go back. It is not named. It remains an element, a condition, a part of statutory definition on the right to free speech. I can't listen to this on right association. The other thing that I want to point out about the language of the counterclaim, in addition to the fact that it could have been brought within a week when Ms. Jackson bought the vehicle, this is just like Bevin versus Beatles, where this court pointed out that all of the facts that this lawsuit is predicated on occurred well before Ms. Jackson filed her lawsuit. And in Bevin versus Beatles, this court also said, you know what? We're not going to get into the timing aspect. There are any number of reasons people choose to do things at various points of time in the lawsuit. That's speculation, it's conclusory, and we're not going to let that enter into the analysis of whether an action, in this case a counterclaim, is based on a response to a lawsuit. And that's the mistake the appellant has made consistently out of the portions of the brief and their argument and hearing the motion for the TCPA motion. They keep saying, well, it's the timing, and we can speculate about why this was brought. It's obviously trying to chill our right court's projected, this has to be, the counterclaim has to be predicated on the exercise and communication by Ms. Jackson in a judicial proceeding or a communication by her pertaining to a judicial proceeding. And it's just not. And with that, this.
Was this counterclaim not a communication in a judicial proceeding?
It's not pertaining to a judicial proceeding. The counterclaim is not predicated on the facts.
But her filing the original claim is a communication in a judicial proceeding, right?
Sure. I mean, it's a petition. It is a judicial proceeding as far as I know. Sure.
And does the... How is that? Is the counterclaim in response to the filing of the petition?
Not under the test the courts have set up, Your Honor. In interpreting based on in response to this court and 11 of the other 14 courts of appeals that I know have said, when we're interpreting that phrase based on in response to, that means that the action that supposedly violates the right to petition has to be predicated on the right to petition. That's how this court has to, as like I said, Harris and the Beatles, we cited in the brief, that predication is missing. The Supreme Court in Creative World talked about the facts have to be premised on the exercise of the right to petition, which is, as I look at it, synonymous with predicate. And since that's the way the courts have interpreted that phrase, in fact, that's how the courts interpreted that phrase based on in response to when it had, still had in the 2019, pre-2019 version, still had the phrase in it, relates to. And with that much broader language, the court said, 11 of 14 courts of appeals said, okay, that means it has to be predicated on the exercise of one of these rights. And when the legislature took out the relates to language in 2019 and narrowed the statute, you were talking about earlier, if they wanted to say something about that test, they could have. All those cases were out there. They didn't. So that's what I think is going on there. There are other reasons this court can hold, if it wants to, that the TCPA does not apply. In my opinion, this our counterclaim is not predicated on her on a communication. And it's predicated on acts that occur outside the filing of the petition. In their cases, we put them in briefs on all the basis. But the court's analysis can literally begin and end with just the fact that the TCPA doesn't cover it because it's not predicated on her exercise of the right to petition. And for the benefit of the students in the audience, it's no surprise that I've heard of the judges refer to this when the court's dealing with that never-ending avalanche of cases. I'm always looking for ways to address things as quickly as possible. I would like to spend a few minutes with the prima facie case portion of this. I don't think the court gets to that analysis. I don't think the TCPA applies behind Act 7 given the timeline. But I want to suggest that perhaps the way to look at this is from the standpoint of the trial judges who dealt with this motion. I've never been a trial judge at my age. I'm not likely to. I realize one member of the panel has been on the trial board for a long time. So it's a little bit presumptuous for me to talk about how trial courts think. But I would say that the two trial judges that signed these orders probably went into the to. Judge Bernard, who is the presiding judge, actually heard the motion for the TCPA motion and signed the original order denying it. Judge Hogan, the visiting judge, who denied Ms. Jackson's no evidence motion for summary judgment, signed the amended order denying her motion for TCPA motion. So you've got two trial judges denying her motion. And what they faced when they went into that process, they faced a statute that said they may not dismiss a legal action. They cannot do it. Number one, if the non-movement establishes by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case for each essential element. And secondly, they face a statute that says the court shall consider evidence the court could consider in Rule 166A in supporting and opposing affidavits. So, when Judge Hogan signs the amended order, which by the way is the only order appealing here, I'm not suggesting the earlier order had it, but when he signed that order denying the TCPA motion, he knew for a fact that he had denied Ms. Jackson's no evidence motion for summary judgment, which she pointed out in her TCPA motion and at the hearing on the TCPA motion, that the counterclaim that Kell Auto filed was nothing more than the affirmative defenses which she had attempted to strike using her no evidence motion for summary judgment. Well, Judge Hogan knew that he had denied that no evidence motion, and he had to have denied it based on the affidavits and the summary judgment evidence that Kellogg and Robert Harmon presented to him. Judge Bernard, the presiding judge, knew when he heard it, because once again, he heard and read the motion, heard the hearing. Ms. Jackson and both of them said, you know, all they did was take their affirmative defenses, convert them to the counterclaim. We filed no evidence motion for summary judgment about the defenses. So Judge Bernard has it brought to his attention that this no evidence motion has been filed. And he also probably knows that literally a week before the hearing on the TCPA motion, and this is in the timeline as well, Kellogg will file a motion for traditional summary judgment motion on its breach of contract counterclaim using exactly the same affidavits and the same evidence. To reverse the judges in this scenario, I think that this court would have to say, number one, the TCPA applies, which we've already talked about why I think it does. But if the court did that and then got to this issue, this court would have to tell both judges, we don't think you even remembered Judge Hogan, the summary judgment evidence and the summary judgment you denied. And furthermore, and Judge Bernard, we don't think you knew what was in your file. But on top of that, even if we were to assume that you did know and didn't remember, you are legally prohibited from considering that evidence. And it doesn't matter if the TCPA tells you that you shall consider evidence for considering Rule 166A and supporting the public cabinet. And if I'm a trial judge and I get that message, I scratch my head as to what I'm supposed to do. There's been some talk about damages here. We pled damages. We've got the cases in our brief, that the MBNM financial case primarily, that talks about if you have a breach of contract claim, that, and there is a breach, that there is a presumption that some damages follow nominal damages if you count. The MBNM case also commented that, or at least implied that personnel having to take action in response to a breach of contract could be the basis of damages. We've put that in our affidavits, we'll belabor that here today. But this court has already held in Miller v. Watkins on TCPA case involved a defamation claim that it was willing to, in terms of providing the damage element as a prima facie element of claim, of a challenge claim, that it would look at the presumptive damages which are available under a defamation claim. It's the same thing here. So I have nothing further to offer. I'm down to the last 2 minutes of time. I'm certainly happy to answer any further questions the court may have. I may have to look at my notes just to see if there's anything else I wanted to mention. Let's see. this town, I mean, following the statutory language as it's been adopted by the courts and not altered by the legislature after those interpretations, I don't think this court has to worry about defining anything about a county line. It's following the statutory language as it's been applied and interpreted. With that, we appreciate the opportunity to argue in front of you. I'll turn the rest of the time back. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes, for that presentation. There's a couple things I want to correct. Mr. Hayes spoke a lot about what judges may have assumed or presumed, and he did not correctly give you how things went down. I know I was there, I heard all these hearings, and I feel it's important to correct that. What actually
does. So, but I want to be interested to hear from you about this when you say that they didn't plead damages. Paragraph 28, they pled damages in excess of the jurisdiction in the court, and then they pled federal attorney's fees. You still think that your representation is accurate?
I do. That's just a sentence that needs to be in there to get jurisdiction in court. That's
what I'm talking about. As soon as it's an application, damages, you said they didn't allege. Paragraph 28 specifically says cause damages. Correct?
Yes.
Texas follows notice of damages, doesn't it?
That's correct.
And then you only have to have a notice of cause special exception, correct?
Yes, that's correct. The other thing I'd like to point out is that opposing counsel puts a lot of emphasis on the evidence within the record to defeat the summary judgment. The motion for summary judgment standard is significantly different than the Citizens Participation Act, the clear specific. All the evidence must be viewed most favorable to the non-moving party, and you just need a scintilla of evidence, which is why I was going to tie it to the judges and how it transpired, not to be disrespectful, but Judge Hogan heard the oral arguments. Judge Bernard signed the order dismissing it. We have no knowledge of what Judge Bernard knew when he signed that order or not. He didn't hear the oral arguments. And then subsequently, Judge Hogan did sign the order to amend the order because the order was not clear on the motions and such. So I just felt that was a significant point to point out. The other thing I would point out is that I do not think that they can go down to the courthouse a week after this transaction and file this claim as they've written it. They violate the law, and then they're going to sue the consumer. The whole purpose of the transportation code is to make sure that when a consumer buys that car, when Ms. Jackson bought her car, she thought she was protected by the laws of the state of Texas, which were it's safe to drive on the road, not only for herself, but all other automobile operators out there. And so their lawsuit is, they're the sophisticated party here. They buy and sell cars every single day. This is the first car she purchased solo by herself as an adult. She went down, thought she asked all the correct questions about the safety features of the vehicle. The salesman, Mr. Harmon at the time, misrepresented to her that those features were good and backed it up by telling her the car had been inspected. I do not think that they could file their counterclaim as a standalone cause of action. I did research quite heavily and I did not find anywhere where an automobile dealer sold a car. Somebody paid cash for it, took possession of it, got a sales receipt, and then sued them for not doing something after the sale had been complete. That is all I have from our rebuttal. Any questions? I'll give the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. That was very helpful. And your case is now submitted.